I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. We're speaking today to Dr. Richard Restak. He's a professor of neurology at the GWU Medical School in Washington, D.C. He's the president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association. He's written 19 books on the brain and neuroethics, and his website can be found at richardrestak.com. His most recent books are The Naked Brain, How the Emerging Neurosociety is Changing How We Live, Work, and Love, and The New Brain, How the Modern Age is Rewiring Your Mind. Welcome, Dr. Restak.
Thank you very much.
You make the argument in The Naked Brain that our growing understanding of neurology through neuroimaging primarily is beginning to provide tools for manipulation of society. And is that what you're primarily referring to when you talk about a neurosociety?
Well, when I talk about a neurosociety, I mean a society in which neuroscience or brain science, if you will, has a distinct contribution to how that society functions, molds itself, thinks of itself, measures itself, so that we have the introduction of brain science into measuring empathy, measuring things like marketing trends, neuroeconomics. So this is what the new neurosociety is all about.
So you have addressed in other books the issues of psychopharmaceuticals and our genetic understandings of the brain and so forth. But it seems like you come from a primarily social and interactionist kind of perspective, emphasizing the plasticity of the brain as opposed to its kind of preformed nature.
Well, I do. In The Naked Brain, that's the emphasis. In The New Brain, which was the Rewiring the Mind, that was a little bit more about the powerful effects of modern psychopharmacology in changing people's thinking patterns and moods. Activity levels, things like that, and the effect that that will have on, you know, things like mourning, whether or not people go through mourning reactions, things like excitement, enthusiasm, and all this. In The Naked Brain, I'm interested in the imaging of different what we would call mind states or mental states that before we had no way of objectifying it except through like paper and pencil tests or interviews or things like that.
You bring a certain amount of skepticism to the growing use of fMRI to attempt to illustrate what is going on in the brain. Can you tell us a little bit about the problems of using that fMRI imaging data?
I think that it's accomplished a lot and will continue to accomplish a lot. It's just that we can't put too much emphasis on trying to pin down aspects of our mind that for various semantic and philosophical reasons we've never been able to agree upon in any case. So it's hard to measure, for instance, whether someone is telling a lie if we haven't really thought through the whole concept of what a lie is actually about. If I'm telling you something that I sincerely believe is true and I'm convinced of it, I'm telling you something that's not true, but I'm not a liar. So showing me an fMRI would be of limited use in terms of picking out whether or not I was trying to deceive you.
You, speaking of that, you have a chapter on information processing in the book and the ways that our growing understanding of information processing is contributing to neuroeconomics and neuromarketing and so forth. Can you give us an example of how understanding how information processing empowers different kinds of interaction?
Well, you take an offer of a certain amount of money in a certain period of time as opposed to getting more money at a later point. That's the executive function of the brain. That's the frontal area of the brain. That would be more active in an fMRI in a person who would be given to making a judgment of waiting to get a little higher payoff. So the fMRI could maybe predict ahead of time just whether or not a person would act impulsively or whether they wouldn't. Of course, that also varies, because if I say to you, would you sooner have $500 or a 50% chance of winning $5,000? Now, there really isn't a neurosignature for that, because there isn't any really correct answer. If you're a wealthy person, you'd probably say, well, I'd sooner just sort of take the 50% chance of getting $5,000. if you could use that $500 to pay your rent or something like that, or I guess a third or a quarter of your rent, then you'd probably take it. Say, well, it's you know, bird in the hand, the money's available, I'll take it. There'd be a different pattern that you'd see on the brain. One would be a more frontal, and the other would be a more impulsive type thing, and it would just take the money that's immediately available. That's the kind of thing you can do. You can also pick out people who are more extroverted and introverted from how they respond to faces, for instance. Show them pictures of smiling faces versus scowling faces. They will, you will be able to tell, according to how much time is spent scanning the face, how quickly, in milliseconds actually, in which the you're measuring, you'll actually be able to distinguish someone who's more of an extrovert from an introvert. That type of thing. It's right here now. We can do it today.
As we begin to understand the variation of impulsivity and shyness in people, we've also come up with diagnostic categories. That social phobia disorder is a category for folks who have too much shyness, and ADD, a category for folks with too much impulsivity. You're pretty critical of that trend in the pharmaceutical treatment of these kinds of conditions. And in fact, I think you make the argument in The New Brain that ADD has a lot to do with the speed of modern life, and are skeptical about pharmaceutical management of it.
Well, I think that there's a lot of culturally induced attention deficit disorder. We live in a time when people have to be very quick and able to maneuver from one thought process to another, multitask, speak rapidly, give very short, pithy, we call them sound bites, short, pithy expressions of thought. That encourages a sort of an attentional deficit type of thinking process in which long, concentrated, focused attention has become a rarity.
You have a long chapter about empathy in the book The Naked Brain.
Yes.
And something that I and my colleagues have been discussing a lot recently is the rise of the Asperger's rights movement and the notion that the autistic spectrum should not necessarily be pathologized. And many of us are puzzled, I think, about what the relationship is between Asperger's and psychopathology. I mean, in what sense does folks with Asperger's not have empathy for other people's feelings, and why does that not lead to psychopathological behavior?
Well, it's a good question. It's the extremes, of course, of fully developed forms in which empathy is totally lacking. You can see that with Asperger's. You also can see it with psychopathy, which is a very different personality constellation. The psychopath, for instance, has a little sense of empathy with other people, although they can be very cunning sometimes in figuring out what response will gain them the most in their interactions with a particular person. You can see empathic responses. I mentioned in The Naked Brain about some meditation, types of meditation, in which one identifies oneself with other people, people suffering, people who are having difficulties, and this will enhance certain brain function that you would, like left frontal specifically, which is a compassion area, or seems to be associated with positive emotions as opposed to negative. We also, as I mentioned in there, there's scientific proof that you can actually alter even the chemistry of your brain. That's an experiment in which actors were told to model certain emotions, and there was changes in what's called the serotonin synthesis capacity, the ability of the brain to synthesize serotonin, the neurotransmitter, a difference in the different brain areas, so that they can actually modulate the SSC, serotonin synthesis capacity, by transiently altering their emotions. Actors doing that, the rest of us doing it all the time. Marcus Aurelius, Roman Emperor, talked about that years ago when he said, you're distressed by the external, the pain is not due to the thing itself, but to your estimate of it. Unless you have the power to revoke that at any moment, change your thoughts, you change your brain, you change your feelings. So I think this is one of the powerful things that we're realizing in the neurosociety. There is, in fact, a direct linkage between the patterns of thought and the patterns of brain function, and each one influences the other. And you can approach it from either side. You can do the chemistry and treating with medications, or actually now it's an actual sort of a signature for us or a positive indicator that some forms of psychotherapy are probably helpful because they modify brain function.
So that's, are you a supporter of cognitive behavioral therapy? And
In general, I am. I've seen the results of it, and I think cognitive, essentially what you're doing in a cognitive framework, as you know, is to get a person to reframe a problem and to not see it in terms of a problem, but perhaps as a challenge. And that, of course, does change the brain. That's just what we were talking about a moment ago, the Marcus Aurelius and the quote. I mean, it's the attitude that you take towards things, the words you use. This always happens to me, or that never happens. And the cognitive therapist points out, you know, obviously words like never and always are really not appropriate to one's experience, to the human experience. There's always examples of both.
So your emphasis would be that we could identify ways to encourage empathy and compassion in our lives. That seems to be pretty simpatico with the positive psychology movement. Are you supporter?
Well, it's funny, you know, because you don't want to be one of these people that just think that you can change the world by, you know, I'm not one of those that says we just have to, you know, can change anything by just taking a positive attitude. But I think you can certainly see the destructive effects of negative attitudes. We also can neutralize them if we identify our emotions. I mentioned in The Naked Brain about experiments which show that even identifying through linguistic processing, just saying, gee, I feel angry right now, that leads to a decreased response from the emotional center of the brain, the amygdala. So if you think of the amygdala and the limbic system as emotional conduits, and the prefrontal cortex is sort of the gating mechanism, the executive force, that controls the amygdala, many of these things can be looked upon as overbalanced one way or the other. The obsessive compulsive, overly ritualistic, overly linear thinker is maybe a little too much prefrontal activity. Whereas the impulsive, the person has difficulty handling emotions of themselves or other people, is probably amygdala hyperactivity.
So there are you can have too much of a good thing. And any
of you look for the balance. Because there is a natural balance within the brain. I mean, we've been taught for years and years that, you know, there's certain parts of the brain have to do with logic and reasoning, and other parts of the brain have to do with emotions. But when you actually get into this through the neurobiology and look at what's been found, we now know that the two of them are intimately interlinked. I mean, every thought has a certain valence to it, a certain emotional underpinning. And sometimes you can detect it, sometimes you can't. Phone rings, you pick up the telephone, and there's a certain person on the phone, and you may be just a little bit of feeling of, gee, I'm glad they called, or a little bit of feeling of, oh, no. You know, you can get sort of, you can become very aware of those things, and by becoming aware of them, you can gain some control over them. So that extent, that's definitely a cognitive behavioral approach.
We're speaking with Dr. Richard Restak. He's the author of more than 18 books on the brain. He's the president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association. You can find him at richardrestak.com. We're talking about the balance of different personality traits and cognitive traits. And you have a wonderful chapter about the neurology of morals and what we're beginning to understand about moral cognition. One of the problems that comes up often in moral philosophy is the notion of a moral monster, someone who is so moral that they do things that other people consider monstrous. And when I read this literature about the neurology of morals, I see you know, some of that happening, that most people, for instance, are willing to sacrifice 100 other kids to save their kid. And that, in an abstract sense, is not a moral decision, but it's something that's kind of deeply wired in us.
Yeah, there's definitely stuff, research going on that's taken up with moral questions in terms of higher order ethical thinking and being able to realize. There's a famous experiment done by Josh Green in the trolley experiment where theoretically a trolley is headed down a track and everybody's going to be killed because you can't bring it to a stop, and yet if you turn the switch it will go off onto a siding. But they're working on the siding as a railroad worker who's going to be killed when this trolley hits them. Most people would be able to work on that and probably pull the switch. But if you put it in a different way and you said, well, how about pushing somebody in front of the trolley? So that brings it to a stop and then it won't kill the people on it. And most people are reluctant to do that because of the moral upbringing that we all have about it's wrong to do something like that. Now, thinking about pushing somebody in front of a trolley activates different areas of the brain involving emotion and heightened vigilance rather than turning a switch. In this case, the heightened vigilance is don't do that. I give the other example in my book of a soldier in it could be Iraq or anywhere, and they see somebody carrying a child and they're heading into a bazaar, and it looks like that they may well be strapped with a bomb, and you have an opportunity to shoot this person before they go in there, but you may also shoot, kill the child. What do you do in a situation like that? That's a high moral kind of decision, and if you remain indecisive long enough, then of course you've already made the decision. You're going to let happen what will happen. These are questions that neuroscience, has never really been called upon to contribute to. And I think it has a lot to contribute to it. I think one of the problems, of course, is to think that we're going to get the answers to these. Well, there really isn't an answer to the dilemma that I just gave to you about the soldier. I mean, what is the value here? Certain people would put no value at all on the child's life, certain parts of the world that say, shoot the terrorist, and if you also kill the child, so what? Other people would say, well, no, you can't do something which might harm this child. So it's not like you're going to search in brain literature and fMRIs and come up with the answer to it. So there's a really good example of my point that neuroscience is not going to give us answers to questions that we haven't really decided about on the basis of ethics and philosophy and morality.
One of the disturbing examples of research that you give in your book is a study that was done on special forces soldiers who excelled at their job, and they were found to not have the same kind of traumatic responses to traumatic events that other people might have. And you suggest that kind of information might be used in the future to do pre-screening for what kind of soldiers should be put into this.
Well, this is something that's going on right now. I've referenced that work in The Naked Brain, and it's a study done at NIMH, and it's just as you described. I'll fill in the details a bit. The soldiers are in the fMRI, and they're looking at flashed pictures of angry or hostile or vicious faces, and they're measuring how they respond, and they do respond like all the rest of us with an immediate amygdala or limbic system response. However, they're able to manage it a little bit by the frontal area immediately comes into action, which you don't see in the ordinary person. So that would, in fact, you don't even see that in the ordinary soldier. So you would say this is somebody who might really be good in special forces because they're able to control these emotional responses. And that's, of course, what you're looking for, somebody who's going to be able to almost absent themselves from the situation in terms of not automatically responding and letting some of these triggers in the brain, fire off from the amygdala and limbic system.
It seems like in some ways these neuroimaging studies and our understanding of the brain is beginning to give some weight to the notion that we have an id and a superego. I think of one recent study where they used transcranial magnets to suppress frontal cortex, and they found that people acted more selfish in competitive games. Do you see that kind of covert validation of a Freudian model coming through?
Well, I've always thought of Freudian model as metaphor, as it's an interesting metaphor that one can use to describe certain processes within the brain. I think where Freudianism got into problems with was that the people then began to think there was actual areas that you could demarcate and define and all this, and these things became reified, if you will. People began to think of them almost as if they were things you could hold in your hand. Whereas they were just metaphorical ways, whether you're going to talk about limbic system and amygdala or whether you're going to talk about id, is really a category. What particular category do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about chemistry? Do you want to talk about a neuroanatomy? Or do you want to talk about a useful but limited metaphor for emotion?
So you also get into neuroeconomics and neuromarketing and some of their applications. Are you someone who thinks that we need to put some brakes on the ways that we're being manipulated using this neuroinformation, or is it pretty much just going to be out there?
Well, I think that the marketing, it's of use, and there's plenty of studies that show that memory is very malleable. One of the concepts that people have is that once something's passed, it sort of remains as it was in our mind. But actually, the past is very, very malleable. You can convince somebody that something happened that actually didn't. I mentioned a study in there where they tried a gave somebody, they said, we're going to give you a new drink that we're going to bring out. We think it's going to be a soda as popular as the colas. It's really going to be really great, and you're going to be one of the first people to test it. They put a little vinegar in it, which doesn't help the taste, and it tasted awful. So that's what people said, this stuff is awful. They said, well, you know, before you leave, we want you to look at some of the videos we have of how other people felt about this soda. And then when they had these actors and people going on about how wonderful it was and everything, the people thought, well, gee, maybe I better taste it again. You know, maybe I was wrong about it. You can convince somebody they were lost at a shopping mall when they were a kid by telling them that, and then later on they'll remember it. Most interesting experiment that I mentioned in there, though, is to just to morph a picture of, there was one in which they took a picture of a man's uncle, and the picture was then morphed of the man when he was about 4 or 5 years of age, well, I guess about 7 or 8 years of age, in a hot air balloon with the uncle. And of course, he had never been in a hot air balloon with the uncle, but he was convinced from the picture that it actually occurred. He remembered all kinds of details about it. I mean, you know, he remembered the day he was taken there and how high up they went and all this. Well, it never happened. So as soon as marketers got involved in that and knew about this, then they realized that you can morph certain feelings and emotions and responses onto experiences. And I mentioned in The Naked Brain about the marketers who gave out a certain product outside of one of the theme parks people were coming out of on their vacation. And, of course, the idea was when they got home, they would remember their experience in the theme park, and it would be morphed onto their experience with this product.
But it seems in a way we're all becoming relatively sophisticated about product placement and
yes.
And the ways that we're manipulated. And some of the ways that that people try to manipulate us, like subliminal advertising, turn out not to actually be that effective. So do you think that we're becoming more cognitively sophisticated and having...
Well, that's true, but let's just step back just for a second. You're right, subliminal advertising was shown not to work because it was set out in a very crude way. If you remember the original experiments that Vance Packard wrote about, it was people sitting in movies and they were flashing things like, you know, buy a Coca-Cola or buy popcorn or something and trying to measure whether that would force people to get up and go buy these products. Well, it didn't work because that's not really what subliminal advertising is really all about. It's just simply intended to increase the likelihood that you're going to do this. And you definitely can show many, many experiments that I mentioned in the Naked Brain would show that you can do this, that you can actually influence the likelihood that someone will buy a product or something. But there's no impulsive aspect to it. I mean, if I showed you a picture of a Ferrari and a picture of a Ford Taurus, I think I could be fairly confident that your brain would respond with more interest and excitement to the Ferrari. But that's not doesn't mean you're going to go out and buy that car and bankrupt yourself or your family or cause all kinds of financial hardship. It's a matter of the frontal lobe kicks in and says, well, you know, this is a nice car, but I can't afford it. However, impulse-driven people, as we call them, that's what impulse disorders are all about. People with bipolar disorders, mania, people who just don't have any sense of limits, they probably go buy the car.
In the concluding part of your book, you talk about ways that in the future that the neurosociety may have some deleterious consequences. One of the ways that you mention is an erosion of a sense of personal responsibility. And so say someone recognizes that they're ADD or they have an impulse disorder. It doesn't necessarily strike me that that leads to an erosion of personal responsibility. It could give you a sense of responsibility to take your Ritalin or to do your cognitive behavioral therapy or something. Do you see a necessary moral or legal erosion of the notion that will can affect your life because of the rise of neuroscience?
Well, the courts are filled with cases, some of which I've testified on myself, in which claims are made that people are not responsible for their behavior because of certain findings on PET scans or fMRIs or things like that, prefrontal hypoperfusion, meaning indicating that they're not getting perfusion in the frontal areas, therefore they can't exert control over their behavior and things like that. So this is not all theory. I mean, this is being fought out on the grounds in courts all over the country.
And another one that you mentioned in the concluding part of your book, and something we talk about here quite a bit, is the rise of cognitive enhancement technologies and the potential of cognitive enhancement technologies, modafinil and the stimulants for ADD and so forth. You point to what many bioethicists are concerned about, the notion that even in a liberal society where people can control their own brain more or less, the competition in the workplace or in schools may lead people to excessive enhancement. So, on the other hand, do you think that people have a right to take these cognitive enhancements?
Well, I think up to an extent, it's the same argument that do people have a right to take body performance enhancers when they're in athletics? And the answer to that is, of course they do, but if they're competing against others and it's the assumption is that everybody's competing without enhancers, then they can't do it, shouldn't do it. So when you have people taking tests that are taking cognitive enhancers, it's very similar to the situation of somebody being in a sports team and taking taking performance enhancers.
But there are so many things that affect our performance. You know, having a family is a distraction for many from their careers, and so we don't consider it unfair for single people to compete against married people.
Well, that's true, single people, but they have their own distractions, don't they? They're faced with what they're going to do with every Friday night and Saturday night and all that. The married people with children, they have to take care of for them. So you could argue either way.
Dr. Resnick, I really want to thank you for your time.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk to you, and thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Dr. Richard Resnick. He's a professor of neurology at GWU. He's the president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association. He's written 19 books on the brain and neuroethics, and you can find his work at richardresnick.com.
Also this week, I want to give a shout-out to the latest member of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies family of thinkers, which is Ann Corwin. She's an engineer and transhumanist in California. She has a blog called Existence is Wonderful, which can be found at rationallongevity.blogspot.com. She writes there frequently about ethics of longevity and issues on the neurodiversity front, because she is a person with Asperger's and is very involved with the issues around the autism spectrum and whether we should be pathologizing various conditions along that autism spectrum. She's a very provocative thinker, and we welcome her. She also has an audio cast, a podcast that you can link to through her Existence is Wonderful blogspot, which is again at rationallongevity.blogspot.com. Welcome, Ann.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.